Hi everyone, thanks very much to Cove for inviting me down. I see Pat Cotter over here. Pat was one of my first ever publishers, Cork Man. And I worked at Poetry Ireland with Theo Dorgan, another Cork Man. And Tom McCarthy, I know he's not a Cork Man, but he does live here, published my first poem that I got into Poetry Ireland, which at the time was be all and the end all to get into way back when. So I feel I have a lot of Cork connections. How did it take you so long to invite me? I have actually been here before, and as we say, I did this last Tuesday. It was launched with Adam Wyatt. We had the same launch, so you have him next week, so there's another connection. And I'll read the first poem that Tom McCarthy put into Poetry Ireland. So it's very, very old poem. It's called In a Stout Jar, and it's not a Guinness jar. It's stout as in the original meaning of the word. Quiet now the night, that long drawn out sigh. An hour now stands between me and soft daylight. A short reprieve, one dusky hour to armour myself against the day's effacing bustle. Quickly I run to store the night's impossible wantings in a stout jar high on some dusty shelf. So I have to see my list here because there's poems being added and subtracted by the minute here. Oh yeah, sorry. If you can see if you can get that to stand up, please, thank you. Yeah, thanks. I have to find them now, hang on. I have went to the great trouble of marking them all up, but then threw half of them out, so it changed. Again, this is a very old poem from one of my first collections. I think it's from the first collection. No, it's my second collection, The Shadow Keeper, 1977. Some of you weren't even born yet. And it's when I worked in Poetry Ireland, for whatever reason, I have no idea, the Russian embassy rang us. Now this is back in 77, so the wall is still there and all this carry on politically. And these Russians had come for a visit to Ireland, but they hadn't been able to bring any money with them. And they wanted to sell us things and to get money. But they were all blind. And this is actually true. This is a true story. I remember thinking, what's going on here? And so this is my poem, Blind Russians Visit Dublin. And why? What made them think we'd go and see the poets, you know? I mean, they came to visit us, the poets, with their wares. Cameras, telescopes, binoculars, all related to the eye. By their sightless gaze we saw they could not see the light, the gleam of shade and shadow. They lived by touch and echoes. Their guiding moon had gone to ground, and like the plover hunting on the shore, they relied on movement and sound. We haggled then as Sargasso seas swam across their irises and held their stare like the shore guiding the shape it has made, not giving an inch. They dreamed of Eyebright, Speedwell, Eyeworth and Blewett. We struck the deal. Money, like a vision, changed hands. They touched the coins, coming along the milled edges, weighing them up. The notes they smoothed out, checking the size, holding up an image of their worth. Their retinas gave back no shapes, clouded as they were like the surface of water in autumn. We checked our purchases, held them to our eyes, looked through the camera's viewfinder, tried the telescope, were all eyes for the binoculars. It's very nice of you to clap, but you don't have to clap through each one. And I'm sorry, unlike a lot of the, especially the younger people now who do the performance poetry, I cannot remember one word of my own poetry, so I have to keep my head stuck in the book. It's age related. This one is called Stitched, and it's a poem about my mother who got her varicose veins done many years ago. and when I was very young, when I came into the room, she hated being at the doctor's. She had a lot of other troubles that involved doctors, which I'll tell you about later. But she was cutting the stitches off herself with her own doctor more or less screaming at her in the doorway to stop. So this is just a poem I wrote, and it's called Stitched. Your scissors flew, ripping all in their path, inches and inches of stitches, tied off like butterflies, the ends going nowhere. Each one neatly ravelled as you pulled and sliced at it. The tapestry pattern that travelled your leg from ankle to groin was impressive to my young eye. The doctor was shocked as he tried to stop you, but you were vehement. They had done your veins, cut and snipped them, turned them inside out, a tailor's dummy. You said you wanted to reclaim the seams that carry the blood back to the heart. There now. This next one is from Dangerous Dresses. That's the handy thing about having a new and selected. You can get all your poems together in the one place, and you don't have to bring lots of different books with you. And this one, sorry, I'm afraid of kicking over this thing. This one is about Amelia Earhart, who was the first person to sail single-handed across the Atlantic, and she went missing a number of years later. When she was flying across the Atlantic, and she was trying to land in Wales, but she landed in a field in Donegal, which I always thought was kind of good, that what the farmers in Donegal would have made of that. And she asked where she was, meaning where in the world am I, and he told her she was in Gallagher's Field, which I really liked that bit. But after she did this, you know, the first person in the world to have done this, French newspapers, and this is why women have to do everything better and do it twice, the French newspapers carried a headline, "Yes, but can she bake a cake?" Of which nowadays, you know what the answer would be, girls, but anyway, you know. So this poem was written on that idea, and it's called "Yes, I Can Bake a Cake." And sometimes in the aching loneliness of taut and unforgiving sky, she wished she'd stayed and baked some more. Time bent and blended into nothing. The engine, a soothing sound, she watched the Vega's instruments and dials, as if their numbered faces would reveal her soul's dominion. She became a two-winged seraphim, flying in heaven's slipstream, that radar operators loved as angel, mistaking her for geese, blown off course and heading east. Instead, she chose to fly from Harbour Grace to some unknown place in Ireland. First landfall after all that blue sea and air. The pasture beckoned green and grounded. A few startled cows felt wind rush past their ears, heard the sound of wings, and saw a red mayfly go past, touch down. A farmer stood his ground and greeted her, said she was in Gallagher's Field and worried would she sour the milk. She came in a broomstick. Are you still all awake? Yeah. Sorry, I'm just looking for this one. Hang on. This one I have to read now while I'm down here, because this is the one that won the Fish International, the very important international poetry prize, if I can find it. I thought I had it marked out somewhere here. Nope. Yeah, I have it. You all know what a Sheilani gig is, I presume?
Yes.
I don't have to explain that bit. And I was somewhere and I read this newspaper report that said one of them had been stolen. I presume quite a few of them are stolen because they're sort of valuable artefacts now. So I wrote it from the point of view of the Sheilani gig herself, because, you know, this sort of image of woman's crone. And that's what it's called, the Stolen Sheelany Gig of Atagara Speaks. Set high above the doorway, under the flying buttress, pockmarked now with age and lately turned to stone, I sat. Know me, I whisper, I am woman, I am crone. With my etched, lashless eyes, hairless head, grinning mouth and triangular nose, how could I tempt anyone? The wind and rain are always at me, lashing me, leaving me lonely. Someone saw me and desired me, swayed by my crude posturing, my endless fertility. When I open my eyes, the world flows in and the world flows out. I have spent all my life so far exposed above Atagara, perched in place, knowing the word through the spread of my lips. In the unconditional dark, someone dethroned me, uncroned me, made me young and beautiful again. I shrieked, leave me be, I am happy. You already paid me well for that one. I'm joking. This is a more personal poem. It's about my mother, who I said I won't return back to. She suffered a lot with mental illness until she finally killed herself when I was about 14. And I found a photo of her a couple of years ago of herself as a young girl of 17 on a swing. You know, one of those very classical pictures. And I just did think, you know, you poor bitch, you did not know what was coming, you know, when her world fell apart. So it's called Before. This is a girl of 17, a side view, seated on a swing, hung from a chestnut tree, her dress hitched by the wind. This is a picture of my mother before I was her daughter, before her father disowned her, before she married my father, before she had six children. This was all before the swinging 60s that could not free her, before the doctors, before the hospital stays grew longer and longer, before they fed the electricity into her poor head that failed to help her, before the priest offered prayer as a cure, before the shock of her own mother's death hit home. This is my mother before I saw her, dead in the bed, her cold hands clutching at air, before life swung full circle and could no longer hold her. This is her on that green day, skirt askew, hair streaming out, holding the ropes of the swing taut, rushing to meet her future, arcing in the air before her. I'm not even sure what book this next poem is from. Oh, I do know it's from Merman, because it's called Merman. I titled the book after it. This is the poem I was very lucky enough to win the Arvon International with, and I was absolutely delighted to win it. And I hope nobody here is working for the tax office or anywhere else that at the time we owed a lot of money to. And I won the 10,000. I said, to hell with the lot of you, and we went on a cruise to the Caribbean, as you do, or as poets do anyway, when someone takes their eye off them. The Caribbean is lovely. I wouldn't bother going back, actually. Quite boring, really. But it was good. Merman. I had been working in the fish farm for weeks, that one near the river outlet and the sea. I didn't like the work. We were constantly wet, dirty. I didn't like the men there either. They were insolent, often dropped small fry and crushed them underfoot. One in particular, Glaucus, tall, muscular, cast his sea green eyes over me, tried to lure me as I tipped phosphorus feed into the holding pens that smoked and stank and made mist veils I tried to hide within. One day he walked towards the tanks, waders held in his large hands. He was chewing on a herb
he said was magical, always urging me to eat it. I would not bite. Anyway, whatever way it was, he leaned to pull the waders on. Both legs got caught in one boot and over he flipped. I cast around for help. No one was there. I went back. He was emerging from amongst the shoals of salmon, clinging to his single wader up to his waist where the glittering scales of smolts. He rose shaking, coloured sequins waterfalling, as he tried to right himself and beckoned me for help. I took the bait, and when I caught him, we stumbled. He landed me and pinned me down. I looked, held his eyes. It was early. The rising sun was flooding them with hooks of golden light. I said no. He parted my thighs, and when it was over, untangled his legs, shook the silver armour from himself. His eyes had lost their lustre. I left distraught and walked all day, stumbling over ditches and hillocks, stopped now and then to eat, following the river to its source. At so many hundred feet, I rested where the stream welled from the earth, cooled my toes, kicked gravel into little pools, and felt the flow snagging in the waters of my womb. I cried and screamed and shook my fists at the sky. Knew then this birthing pool was to be my fate. Tried to obliterate his sea-green eyes, his face, his terrible merman tail.
A drink of water now. How are we doing for time?
We're getting there.
Here's another one on a lighter note. This is from a true story. I was over in Texas, as you are, visiting an artist. The Arts Council very kindly paid my fare for me. And she had a swimming pool, a very successful artist in Texas. And she said, you know, we must go for a swim, honey. Now I have to add, this woman was around my age, a size 4, if you know what size 4 is, very small, and she'd had a little bit of work done, as you do. And she says to me, you know, we're going swimming, honey, and I come out in my togs and whatever, and she looks at me and says, we're going skinny dipping. And I go, yeah, I would too if I was you, Mrs., but I ain't going skinny dipping. And I found, now, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I'd have gone skinny dipping, but not at this stage in the game. I actually found, strangled up out of my mouth was, I said some nonsense like, I'm Irish, we don't take our clothes off. I thought it was like some nun had spoken to me from some other life. You know, the woman now thinks I'm bonkers, of course, but I did get a poem out of it. Skinny dipping. I'm Irish. We keep our clothes on, most of the time. We perform contorted dances on beaches in Cork or Donegal, undressing under not yet wet towels, worried that any gap might expose us, lay some body part bare. It was the Immaculate Conception that did it. If Mary could conceive a child without removing her knickers, then by God the rest of us could undress and swim without baring our buttocks. We swam serene in freezing seas, goosebumps freckling our pale skin. We lay togged out on wet sand, desperate for the weak sun to dry us, before performing the contorted dance in reverse. Now as I remove my clothes, peel them off layer by layer, down to the bare, a brief moment of unease, before the release of water, baptizing skin, with a quiet, Jesus, Mary, I dive in. How are we doing there, Paul? How are we doing? Sorry.
We're okay.
Two more?
Yeah.
Two more, but not if we have
two more.
Two more is fine. Okay, on a more serious note, this is a poem I wrote, and I know a lot of poets try to kind of use or work on the same idea, because I think it's stuck in all our minds, about Jean McConville, one of the missing from the north, mother of 10 children, basically killed because she was married to a Protestant, and really for no other reason, I believe, no matter what anyone tells me. And they searched for her for 30 years and eventually found her. And this poem is just from the idea of her hearing the diggers coming near. And it has a little quote in it, and, "Oh, the bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling, but for you, not for me," from The Dead Soldier by Brendan Behan. "Where I am is dark and dank, though I feel the constant motion of the oyster catcher and hear the curlew and wash of waves as they inch up the mottled sand that silvers out like dull coins in sunlight. I have been buried here over 30 years, here on Shilling Beach, where humankind betrayed me and itself, my neighbours, for whatever God's sake. I knew them, but didn't really. I wouldn't know their kind. At night, marum grass moans when the breeze blows low over the strand. It was like a terrible creation. For 6 days they tormented me, asking, asking, asking. Entrenched, they had no answers. They flayed my flesh, and on the 7th day rested a gun snug to my skull and pulled the trigger. 10 poor souls dug into the dark with me, my blighted children. Oh, they remained in air, but their spirits are harbored here. When gulls call, I feel the crumble of my white bones. As the roiling sea sucks at me, I know its pull and tug through the rising layers of sediment. All I did was comfort a dying man. I didn't see his uniform. He lay on the cold pavement amid cigarette butts, dog turds and chip wrappers. I wanted him to hear a human voice as his life ebbed, to have a thread of sound to go down with. Oh my God, I am heartily sorry for having offended thee. My ears got stopped with grains of sand, but I believe they can still hear my voice calling and calling like the curlew out over the years, and I sense somewhere at hand, beside the constant fluent lapping of the tides, the answer of machinery and diggers coming near. After that first death, there were others. The immensity of the capricious sea and froth of waves on the shore are lacing and hitching themselves like an eager bride to her veil." That's Jean McConville. And the last poem isn't in a book yet. And you know, all the celebrations we've been having on the rising made me think of, this is a very irreverent one, made me think of the 50th anniversary of the rising. Yes, I am that old. And I think we all got a day off school, it was great. But the same year, on the year of that, was the year that the IRA blew up Nelson's Pillar. And then the army came and made a complete mess of it all together, blew out all the windows in O'Connell Street, etc., etc. And I had an unfortunate experience at it, and my poem is called Revising the Rising. 50 years ago, I am on the cusp. Later that summer, I will turn 14. We're gathered at the remains of the pillar, Nelson's granite, glittering rubble at our feet. The surging crowd moves forward. I'm crushed at the police barricade as we reach to gather stones as souvenirs amid the destruction on O'Connell Street. The 50th anniversary of the rising. Dust clogs our throats. The excited crowd shoves from all sides. In our new republic, metal barriers are corralling us, holding us back. At last my attention
pulls away from the desire to collect rocks. Behind, a man is moving rhythmically against me, my struggle to escape only making him thrust harder. In the heated air of wreckage from the bomb, no one notices the trouble I am in. Eventually, he pushes off in the crowd, and I feel my innocence go with him, bits of the pillar dirtying in my pocket. Thank you very much.